So I feel in quite a rhythm here. It's a shame that we don't have such huge amounts of time together. I will come back. Thank you. I got invited. So I'm going to just talk a tiny bit further about loving kindness and then go on to compassion, sympathetic joy, and if I don't do equanimity in this session, I'll do it later in the afternoon, but maybe we'll get there anyway, we'll see. And so back to the idea of practicing or deepening the development of loving kindness to transform our field of intention, which is the primary aim of doing the practice, so that we're coming from a different place in how we live. It's also true that in a very traditional culture, like a place like Burma, where I did quite a bit of this practice, that it's believed that while the primary aim is the transformation of oneself, that loving kindness is also like an energy. It's like a force field. And that it may not be inconsequential to the world. But that's also taught with the cautionary note that, like any gift we give someone, we can't absolutely determine how they will use it, or if they will use it, if they will appreciate it or discard it. And so in order to keep loving kindness from falling into attachment, there's also that understanding. So it doesn't mean nothing happens in the world around us, you know, but it's not actually why we do it, because you never know. So it's not the same thing as saying, you know, well, my loving kindness failed because you didn't get well, or something like that, which would be really kind of a mistake in thinking. Yet it's not believed that there is no sort of energetic manifestation. And so I'll tell you another train station story, which was from a time that I was teaching in California, in Oakland, California, and like this experience also, it was a non-residential weekend in loving kindness, and people were, just because of the situation of where the building was, people were often going and doing their practice, their walking practice on the train platform, and then coming back into the hall. So this woman came back after one walking session and she said, I had this really incredible experience where I would just stand there on the train platform, and as people got off of the train, I would offer them loving kindness. You know, may you be well, may you be happy, silently. And she said, and then this one guy got off the train and I started judging him right away. I started thinking, I don't like the way he's dressed, he looks really uptight, he's like not my kind of person. But nonetheless, despite the judgment, she kept offering him loving kindness, you know, using those phrases. So, and then the man came up to her and he said, I don't ever do anything like this in my life, but I'd like to ask you to pray for me. He said, you just seem to have this really loving presence, and I'm about to go through this very difficult ordeal, and I just want to ask you to pray for me. So then she came back in the hall and said, look what just happened, you know? So there's always that. But we don't do a practice thinking it's going to help us wrest control over the changing circumstances of life, that we're going to be able to dominate pleasure and pain and so on. It's just not true. But as we're different, of course, dynamic shift, perhaps. And there are different changes that happen. And I want to go back to just the idea of emotion or feeling. Because I myself have put in quite a number of hours of doing loving kindness practice without feeling anything, only to discover something actually happened, even while I thought nothing was happening, that I really tend to emphasize this point. It's because we're putting our hearts there, because we're including rather than excluding, because we're working to let go of our fears and coming back to what we really value. Even if we don't get this great rush of emotion, something's happening on another level. And so you don't need to despair. And I thought of that just now because I remember a friend of mine coming to sit at IMS, where, as I said, we go through the, in an intensive metta retreat, we'll go through the range of the different categories of beings. And he chose as his difficult person his former business partner. And it had been a very kind of acrimonious breakup of the firm. And he said he used this person as his metta object, and he offered him a lot of loving kindness, and he felt just nothing. And then he left, and he went back home, and at some point there was another negotiation meeting to continue on with the dissolution of the firm. And he said his former business partner walked in the door, and my friend looked up at him and said, "Hi, how are you?" And the guy said, "Is that you?" It was like the first human exchange that they had in a very long time. So we don't know what's going to happen on any level from our work. But we work really for, to begin with, for our own transformation, which we do believe will ripple out in all kinds of different ways. So, the next Brahmavihara is compassion, which is defined as the trembling or the quivering of our hearts in response to seeing pain or suffering. It's based on, first of all, seeing pain as pain. If we look at our own jealousy, our own fear, our own anger, our own greed, and we don't call those qualities wrong and bad and terrible, we don't call ourselves wrong and bad and terrible for their arising, but rather we see them as painful states, then we will have a very different response to them. So we actually encourage people to make that translation in their minds when such states arise, to say, "This is suffering," and see what then happens. Because it's true. And just as it's true for us, it's true for others as well. So to see pain as pain. And even more than just seeing pain as pain, it's the ability to be there in a certain way, so that our own discomfort, our own fear, our own guilt, our own grief is not taking center stage with someone else's pain being what we're witnessing. Because if they do, then ironically enough, it's about us again and not about them. So that's not to say we dismiss those feelings that we have, but we can actually return to that act of witnessing someone's situation, you know, of suffering or discontent or sorrow. Now, pain, as we bear witness to it, doesn't necessarily mean, it can mean, but it doesn't necessarily mean a time of grave suffering. Because really part of what we are recognizing is the universality of our vulnerability. That we could be going along just fine, and it wouldn't take much. And that this world, this life, is completely unstable. And we actually know that, don't we? That You could be walking down the street and get one phone call, and then it's a different life. And that's true for everybody. We share that, just as we share our urge to be happy. And so, we have this sense of being with. Not standing apart and somehow bestowing kindness, but really that sense of being with, in connection to that urge to be happy, to that vulnerability to change that we all share. So that's like the base of this movement of the heart. It's not about feeling bad, because if we feel really bad, to the extent that we've fallen into the near enemy of compassion, then we're just devastated. So the near enemy of compassion, well, the foreign enemy to begin with, is cruelty. It's having such a strong sense of otherness with some being, person, creature, something, that it doesn't seem to count what happens to them. We don't have that resonance of empathy because we don't recognize that this being also wants to be happy, also is so vulnerable. So that's cruelty. It's like a very cold state, really, of separation. The near enemy of compassion is a state that's quite hard to translate. Sometimes it's translated as grief or sorrow. It doesn't mean grief in the Western psychological sense in which we say grief. It means a state of being shattered, of broken by suffering that we see. Being exhausted, being drained by it. And it only makes sense, doesn't it, that if that's what we fall into, there's not a lot in us where we feel I have something to give or I want to be there, or there's no sense much of resourcefulness inside or an ability to sustain an effort, because it's like way too much. It's like many years ago, Joseph Goldstein and I went to what was then the Soviet Union to teach, even though it was illegal at the time, to teach meditation there. So we went as part of a tour group, and then we would just like disappear every afternoon. And instead of going on tour for the afternoon, we'd go to people's living rooms with a translator and teach. And so I was talking a lot about compassion. And whenever I was talking about compassion, I would just kind of sense this really funny feeling in the room. So finally I sat down with the interpreter and I said, when I say compassion, what do you say? And they described the state. They said it's like you are broken. You know, you're just like torn apart. You're just destroyed by the suffering. And they said it's like someone has taken a giant stake and driven it through your heart. And I thought, well, no wonder this is a really funny feeling. But we can go there, actually. You know, we can mistake compassion for overwhelm. And they're actually really different when we look carefully. It's easy to get overwhelmed. There's no doubt about that. And to feel nearly destroyed by the suffering that we see. But it's different than compassion. Now, compassion is said to have its own sort of energy because we feel so at one. And we are not getting lost in feeling we are responsible to fix everything. Because when we get into that mind state, then again, first of all, it's about us, ironically enough, and we do an extra thing, which is really laying claim to a right to be in control, which is not going to happen. It doesn't mean, of course, that our efforts are inconsequential. We can and must and should try in many situations to try to make a difference and make someone's situation better and make this a better world. But ultimately, it's not up to us. Just like you can't decide how someone's going to receive your gift, right? can't determine, oh, you're going to love that book more than any book you've ever gotten in your whole life, right? We'd like to, but we can't. So sometimes, my favorite word these days, actually, which I find I'm using a lot, is poignancy. There's a certain sense of poignancy when you want to help resolve someone's suffering, and you try. And you also need to let go a little bit. Because what else can we really do in truth, in wisdom? And so compassion has a kind of energy to it that's different. And I'll talk about equanimity sometime this afternoon. It's got this element of equanimity, which means spaciousness. It's a real spacious stillness that sees things as they are, rather than feeling so acutely, we have got to make it all better by tonight. It's recognizing maybe healing has its own rhythm, or life is what it is, and we will do everything. And sometimes what we're doing is actually planting seeds, which will need to bear fruit in their own time, in their own way. It's like Joseph sometimes tells a story, maybe he'll tell it in London too, I don't know, about, I think he was about 9 years old, and he was planting his first, and I think his only garden. And he said he gets so excited when the little green fluffy stuff would come up on top of the carrots that he'd pull them up to help him grow faster. So I think that's maybe why it was his only garden. He didn't have much of a harvest. But we can be so like that, right? So compassion needs to connect to a bigger picture of life, rather than having this sense of trying to assume control. Because we will break. It's just too brittle a state to feel I've got to fix it all. We will be devastated. We will be exhausted. And that's not really that helpful in the end. I go back again to the Dalai Lama when I think of this. Some years ago, he came to New York City and he gave some teachings in a theater they rent. And then he gave a big public talk in Central Park. And there was no fee, there was no registration, so there was no way of knowing how many people would come. And the day before, it actually rained quite a lot, so we all wondered, you know, how it would be. But the day he was actually speaking in the park, it was very clear. And I got up in the morning and walked to Central Park, and I couldn't see anything. But I could hear the sound of Tibetan chanting in the distance, so I followed the sound. And I turned a corner, and there was like a sea of people. Just everywhere the eye could land, there were people. The estimates for the day were about 250,000 people. So it was extraordinary, and we waited for him to begin speaking. When he first began, he started with a statement I found rather startling when he said about himself. He said, you know, from a certain point of view, it hasn't been such an easy life. He said, I had to assume temporal power when I was 16. I had to flee into early exile in my early 20s. I have had to try to keep intact an exiled community for all of these years. I've had to nearly daily hear about the terrible suffering inside of Tibet. He said, it hasn't been such an easy life. And then he said, but I'm pretty happy. You know, just like that, I'm pretty happy. And of course, that's what one tends to see in him. He doesn't seem like overcome and morose. I'm pretty happy. He said, the reason that I'm pretty happy, even though it hasn't been an easy life, is because of the force of compassion. Compassion makes me feel at one with everyone. There's a certain resiliency in compassion, connecting to something really vast and open in compassion. So it's quite remarkable, because I was sitting there in this crowd of all these people and thinking, Well, I bet a lot of the 250,000 or so gathered here could say it hasn't been such an easy life. And not so very many of us perhaps could have then added, but I'm pretty happy. You know, so compassion is not, it's not a superficial state, and there's a very deep exploration to be made in the process as we look at layers and layers and layers and layers, and to be able to distinguish it from this other state, which one translator suggested to me be called despair, something like that. You know, and that's the process we go through as we do this kind of practice. And then the next Brahma-Vihara is, it's almost like the energetic complement to it, which is sympathetic joy, which means developing happiness and the happiness of others. If compassion helps us truly open to suffering, then sympathetic joy helps us truly open to joy. To actually be happy as we witness someone else's success or good fortune. And I think we tend to know the beauty of that state because we know what it's like when we receive it and when we don't. You know, something really good happens for you and some people are so happy for you and it feels like such a gift. Whereas other people, it's like they may smile, but you really get the feeling they would be just fine if it all fell apart. And it feels so terrible. And some people actually seem to have this quality just naturally. It's part of their makeup. They just delight in other people's happiness. For many of us, it's a training. It too is a practice. Not in making believe we feel something we don't. It's not that kind of practice. But in, again, it's a certain elasticity or flexibility of attention so that we see what happens. We see what assumptions we're holding, what projections we're making. Because so much of that envy or jealousy, which is the far enemy of sympathetic joy, the clear opposite, comes from some kind of mistaken perception or conclusion. So say it's a conclusion about permanence, like you have everything and you will forever, and I have nothing and I will forever. That's a mistaken notion. Or happiness is a limited commodity in this world, and the more someone else has, the less there's going to be for me. It's also a mistaken notion. Or, and this is a funny one, it's kind of hard to describe, there's some sense almost like the accolade or the prize or the good fortune was like floating around in the air, and it was heading right for me. Except for the fact it landed on you. And if it hadn't landed on you, it definitely would have landed on me. It's quite bizarre, but we feel it, don't we? You know? And sometimes, of course, we are in direct competition. We both apply for the same grant or the same job. If you get it, I don't. But a lot of times it's not like that, but we live as though it were like that. And so we live with a great sense of being cut off, being embittered, being frightened, feeling ripped off. Also in a situation where we are quite not in control. I told a story once about once I was teaching at IMS, a retreat, and I gave a talk on sympathetic joy, this ability to have happiness and the happiness of others. And I was describing envy or jealousy in this way. I said, it's like you're in New York City and you wake up on Sunday morning and you go by the New York Times and you open it up to the book review section and look on the list of bestsellers. And you see that your friend's book has gotten on the New York Times bestseller list, and you think, wow, was meant to be my book. And it would have been my book if only it had not been their book. That it was kind of coming right at me, and then the New York Times bestseller did a detour and somehow quite undeservedly landed on them. And by the oddest of coincidences, I happened to have three different friends in the group sitting in the retreat, each of whom had books on the New York Times bestseller list. So they each came up to me, actually, and said, "Is that how you felt?" And you saw my book on the list? And I said, "No." Which, of course, I hadn't actually felt that way, because I didn't even remember. It was just one of those experiences where the words came out of my mouth. There it was. But it's easy to feel jealous and envious unless we challenge a lot of those assumptions and see much more clearly. Here, again, I come back to the Dalai Lama, who said it only makes sense to develop happiness in the happiness of others, because then our chances of experiencing happiness increase 6 billion to 1. So those are very good odds. So it's like a better way to live, really. So these three qualities, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, can be practiced as, and equanimity, which I'll talk about later, you know, can be practiced as distinct practices devoted to the development of that particular quality. More generally, we kind of bring them together and do something as a basic framework, something like loving kindness, where we are also working with developing sympathetic joy. Remember yesterday when we offered loving kindness to the friend who was enjoying success? We also work with developing compassion. Those who are hurting, those who are frightened, those who are lonely, or maybe with our difficult person, where we can't really come to wishing them happiness, but we can feel the constraint, the limitation, the pain, the kind of almost futility of a life spent harming others. Or this very beautiful saying from the Buddha, where he said, if you truly loved yourself, you'd never harm another. And recognizing how little love for oneself is often at the root of harming, whether it's our own actions or someone else's. So we can generate compassion very often. So that's basically what we've been doing, is just using a framework of loving kindness practice to actually work with all of these. And equanimity is always, always present, whether named or not, because, you know, as I'll talk about later, and as you probably know already, equanimity can be seen as the voice of wisdom. It's the kind of balance that comes from wisdom. So it's always there. So then, just to go back and finish the model, the far enemy is sympathetic joy, is envy, or jealousy. The near enemy, I've seen described in a variety of ways. One way sometimes it's translated as giddiness. It's just being happy for no reason, not because you're witnessing the happiness of others. So that didn't do that much for me. Another way I've seen it described is comparing. It's not looking at someone else's situation for the sake of being happy for them, but more to kind of check out who you are in reference to where they're at. And so in the Buddhist psychology, the state of comparing is said to be an unwholesome or unskillful state, which means it causes suffering. No matter what conclusion you come to when you do the comparing, you may decide you're better than somebody or worse than somebody or equal to them. It's the very act of, like, always checking people out to see, you know, what status they have, what position they have, what kind of accomplishment they have. It's the restlessness of that and the endlessness of that that makes it unskillful. So I think to see the near enemy of sympathetic joy is comparing, I think, is a useful model. Okay, so why don't we do some walking meditation before another gentle English rain down upon us. We'll come back, I'll talk about equanimity, we'll sit, we'll hang out, we'll have all kinds of time together. Equanimity means balance of mind, and it's the kind of balance that's born of wisdom. Like that wisdom which says, I'm not in control of the unfolding of events. I will be here absolutely for you and do what I can to try to make a difference. And in the end, I can't decide for you how to live. I can't make your choices for you, even though I may be right. I can't wrest control over this situation. It's not resignation, it's not apathy, it's real balance. I think of equanimity as a kind of spacious stillness of mind that realizes how things actually are. There's a tremendous component of equanimity in mindfulness. When we say mindfulness is the ability to be aware of what's happening without adding, holding on, pushing away, that's equanimity. It's because there's equanimity in mindfulness that it creates the platform for seeing even more clearly, going even more deeply, so it's like a reciprocal relationship. Equanimity is a quality in and of itself, and a practice in and of itself, in relational terms, is the fourth Brahma-Vihara. And it's also, I think, the secret ingredient in the other three Brahma-Viharas, because it's said that equanimity helps prevent the Brahma-Vihara state from falling into its near enemy. So it helps loving-kindness not become attachment. It helps compassion not become that state of overwhelm. And it helps sympathetic joy, because of that wisdom quality, of it's not really the case that, for example, you have everything and you will forever. It helps sympathetic joy not to fall into that just kind of endless loop of comparing. It also said to be equanimity that allows the Brahma-Viharas to be boundless. So it's not just for our favorite people, for example, that we feel sympathetic joy, but we have a much broader understanding of life and the nature of life. So the Buddha talked about equanimity as balance, born out of seeing how things actually are. One of the ways of describing that seeing is in terms of the eight vicissitudes, where the Buddha talked about life being made up of pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute, and said, this is how it actually is. Everybody has pleasure and pain. Everybody has gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute. This is part of the fabric of life. This is the fabric of life. And so this is what we share. We go up and we go down. And to recognize this doesn't mean we give up on ourselves or on anyone else. But when we do make an effort, it's with wisdom, rather than with a kind of clinging. I need you to get better by tonight. Or hurry up, would you? Or that state of overwhelm which is the near enemy of compassion, which is so easy to fall into. Equanimity is realizing how things are and having a broad, broad perspective. I think sometimes of going back to that Tibetan example of have see the thoughts that go through your mind as being like clouds that go through the sky? It's like a big expanse with all kinds of different clouds moving through. And we see them, not thinking one kind of cloud is another kind of cloud. We see them for what they are. But we also see them with this really big perspective. So I have a goddaughter in life. She's now about 11 years old. And when she was about 4 years old, she said to her mother, "Sharon is my godmother." And her mother said, "Well, you know, you have to ask." So they asked, and I said, "Sure, you know, I would love that. That would be an incredible honor. That's so great." So we've had a relationship through these years. And then when she was about 8 or so, she started sending me emails to her mom. And the first email says something like, "I've been thinking about things, and I wonder if you can help me out. Where did the universe come from? And where did space come from? Where did love come from? And does space and love have anything to do with one another? Please tell me everything you know." I was like, "Oh my gosh, what do I do now?" So fortunately, there's this very beautiful quotation from the Buddha in which he said, "Develop a mind so filled with love it resembles space, which cannot be painted, cannot be marred, cannot be ruined. Develop a mind so filled with love it resembles space." So if somebody were standing here in the room just throwing paint around in the air, there's nowhere in the space for the paint to land. So in the end, it's not going to make a difference if it's a very well-chosen color or a really garish mistake. The space is going to be free, unimpeded, unconfined, unconstrained. So I wrote back to her and I said, "Well, you know, the Buddha said, the Buddha had this quotation, develop a mind so filled with love it resembles space." And I said, it's like you can have a really, really big mind and heart like the sky. And all these different clouds come through. It's like if somebody at school said something that hurt your feelings, you know, you would see it and maybe it would hurt, but you'd have this big kind of space around it. And I said, that's different than being like a sponge, you know, when you just like soak it in and it fills you completely and you end up all kind of like soggy and yucky, you know. So I wrote all this to her and then I didn't hear from her in response. But then maybe, I don't know, like a month later, her mom told me that she got into a fight with her little sister. And Will, my goddaughter, was going around the house muttering, "I am like the sky, I am not a sponge. I am like the sky, I am not a sponge." Since I never had any children, I wasn't that sure that was a good thing or not. But her mother was delighted. She said, "Wow, she's working it, you know, she's trying to make it real." There's some spaciousness of perspective. If we have no equanimity, we're like a sponge. We bring it all inside, we take it to heart, we get all overcome. It fills us, we end up very soggy and yucky. As compared to a really open space, where we see things just as they are. But we understand this is the truth of things. So we do go up and we go down. And I love, you know, particularly those examples around praise and blame in that description of pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute. Because it's so easy to see that the very same situation, motivated by whatever's motivating us, executed with whatever skill we can bring to bear on a situation, will elicit praise from some people and blame from others. You know, it's like going back to the example I used this morning where, you know, maybe out of a very beautiful motivation, I hand somebody the flyer. about Joseph's talk. And I thought about the best way to do it, you know, so I take you aside and I do it privately and I say whatever as I do it. But maybe just now on his break, his walking period, you know, you checked your cell phone messages and discovered you just won, you know, like $10 million in the lottery. It's like you could not care less about this fire. And you sort of nod distantly and walk away. You know, what does that mean about my heart? What does that mean about my gift? What does that mean about my generosity? Nothing. But isn't it the arena that we tend to land our sense of integrity on to decide how we are and who we are and if we did well and if we deserve to live or not? And yet we can't do anything about it. You can't really say to somebody, something's going to happen at 3:15, and I want you to come into the room. Please don't check your email. Don't check your cell phone. Don't have a conversation with anybody. And don't be thinking about anything. I want you to come in as a completely blank slate. It's not going to happen. Because every moment of existence is a confluence of conditions coming together and coming apart. That's the nature of things. And so, in the development of equanimity, when we are looking to see the integrity of our actions, we look back at our motivation. Where were we coming from? We look at our level of skillfulness, of communication, of manifestation, of execution. And we look at what we would call the immediate response with some balance, realizing that, you know what, it is never going to be the case where you do something and every single person in the universe thanks you for it. It's just not going to happen. And so the Buddha himself said there's always blame in this world. And the way he described it was, there's always blame in this world. If you say nothing, some people will blame you. If you say a lot, some people will blame you. If you say just a little bit, some people will blame you. And the story that they tell about it comes from the time of the Buddha, where they say this man came to the monastery one day to hear something of what the Buddha was teaching, and the person he came upon was a monk who had taken a temporary vow of silence. So when this man asked him, what does the Buddha teach? He remained silent. And the man got really furious and stomped away. So the same man came back a second day and came upon another disciple of the Buddha's who was very renowned not only for his great depth of practice and experience, but for his vast theoretical knowledge. So when he was asked, he gave a very elaborate theoretical response, and the man got furious and stomped away. So the same man came back a third day, came upon yet another disciple of the Buddha's, this monk named Ananda, and they say that Ananda, having heard what happened on the first day and what happened on the second day, was careful to say something, but not too much. And the man got really angry. And he said, how dare you treat such profound matters so sketchy in this way? So this group of people went off to see the Buddha, and they said, oh Lord Buddha, this is what happened on the first day. This is what happened on the second day. This is what happened on the third day. What do you have to say? And the Buddha said, there's always blame in this world. If you say nothing, some people will blame you. If you say a lot, some people will blame you. If you say just a little bit, some people will blame you. There's always blame in this world. And it doesn't mean we don't care. Of course we care. We would like to be praised, we would like to be thanked, of course. But how much do we care? Are we completely undone because we didn't get only praise? Do we think our act is worthless because we didn't get thanked in precisely the way we thought we should be? So the immediate response to an action has two components to it. One is the response part, which is what I've just been talking about. There's praise and blame and praise and blame and praise and blame. And we do care, of course. But we can also check in on how much we care. Are we being a little sponge-like in this? Thinking we should be able to control when in fact we will never be able. And the other part of it is the immediate part of it. Because so often when we do or say something, really what we are doing is planting a seed. And we cannot determine just when and how it will bear fruit. Although we want to, of course. And we're so keyed into like immediate gratification that we feel very, very frustrated. We have to remember that what we see in front of us may not be the end of the story. It's just what we see in front of us. You know, maybe some time later that person's going to take a closer look at the flyer or the book. Maybe things will ripple out, as they often do, in this vast world of interconnection. We need to have, it's almost a sense of mystery or not knowing. We need a bigger picture of life where we can say, okay, I acted from the best place I could in the best way I could. It's out of my hands. And sometimes when we're very lucky, we do see the fruit later on, as actions do ripple out. So the far enemy of equanimity is, you could say, reactivity. It's attachment and aversion, holding on, pushing away. The near enemy of equanimity is indifference. Equanimity does not mean indifference, although it could easily be confused. Indifference, not caring, sullenness, withdrawal, it's not the same. Equanimity really is that kind of balance that comes from wisdom. And it doesn't take away from the force of loving kindness or compassion or sympathetic joy. It actually enhances the force of these qualities by keeping them from falling into their near enemy, by helping them be more boundless, and by helping them be sustained. I mean, how do we hang in there in a situation of pain where we feel compassion and we can't make it all better? How do we offer loving kindness without being able to guarantee a result? It's through the force of equanimity, which is a tremendous strength, actually, in life. But here, too, the word is confusing. It's not that appealing, really, you know. It may not have a sense of emotional intensity that we would find fulfilling, but it's an extraordinary state to really have that much balance, that much steadiness, that much spaciousness of mind and heart, all of which can be born out of wisdom. So these are the four Brahmin hearts. Whether it is ever named or not, always we're practicing equanimity, because otherwise it really would be like, may you be happy so I can move on to someone else, or, you know, whatever version of that would come to be. So let's do some loving kindness practice now. Once again, you can just begin with the extension of loving kindness to yourself, using the phrases that really seem best for you to use.